I don't know what it will take before corporations and governments realize that people are not, that we know it's not working. There may have to be a worldwide strike. I don't know, but obviously reality itself is not enough to make corporations and governments do what they need to do. And part of the problem is that the poorest people with the fewest resources are the most affected.
It's been argued that greenwashing is just another way of scamming the hopelessly naive. For example, using a green pretext to protect U.S. economic interests, the administration of U.S. President Joe Biden recently announced that it is launching Inflation Reduction Act. Biden's move is conveniently framed as a green energy initiative.
To a groundbreaking chips and science law that's going to ensure that technologies and jobs of the future are made here in America. In America. And all this progress is part of our vision and plan and determined effort to get the job done for the American people.
It offers U.S. consumers tax incentives to buy American electric cars with batteries that have at least 40% of components from the U.S. or a country with which it has free trade. This is clearly an attempt by the U.S. administration to seize concerns about global climate crisis to protect the interests of U.S. businesses. But the move has triggered an angry response from the U.S.'s European allies, including France and Germany, who've accused Washington of using green strategy as a tool to protect its own interests. There are now calls within the EU saying that greenwashing of the protectionism scam is something that the EU state should be copying. It is now feared that it's only a matter of time before a Western government would use an environmentally pretext for self-serving economic reasons.
We have already explained to you what greenwashing is, but what we didn't tell you is that this is not a new phenomenon and has been going on for quite some time, even decades, especially in the US. During the 1960s, the contemporary environmental movement began to gain steam. The airwaves, newspapers, and magazines began to fill with newly greened corporate images. In the year 1969, public utilities spent more than $300 million on advertising. That was more than eight times what they spent on the anti-pollution research they were touting in their ads. Then came the 80s and 90s, where greenwash ads increased and became more sophisticated. This was especially evident in the 1990 on the 20th anniversary of Earth Day. One-fourth of all new household products that came onto the market in the U.S. around the time of Earth Day 20 advertised themselves as recyclable, biodegradable, ozone-friendly, or compostable. In the early 1990s, one poll found that 77% of Americans said that a corporation's environmental reputation affected what they bought. The 21st century saw big oil conglomerates capitalizing on the green agenda, which included names like BP and Shell. BP, the world's second largest oil company and one of the world's largest corporations, advertised its new identity as a leader in moving the world beyond petroleum. Yet, it has spent $5 billion over 5 years for oil exploration in Alaska alone. And finally, there are other forms of greenwash that carry the same misleading approach with the ultimate goal of attracting customers. Bluewash refers to corporations that wrap themselves in the blue flag of the United Nations in order to associate themselves with UN themes of human rights, labor rights, and environmental protection. And sweatwash, associated with child labor and sweatshop abuses, companies notorious for the use of sweatshops, used to divert attention from their factories' practices. Example include Nike, Reebok, and other major clothing and fashion brands, a practice which is continued till this day. That's the end of this part of the program.
This program covered a topic which companies have used to sell their products to environmentally friendly consumers or shoppers or buyers who care about the climate change. And that's really a good incentive. While many companies, not all, however, are guilty of not doing that, here's another thought. Green energy right now, when there's an energy shortage, do you think that it makes sense? It should. Don't get me wrong, but it's really just a myth. The world is facing an energy crisis like never before. I mean, electric cars? Who's got the money to pay for the electric bills? Meanwhile, our Earth, us, me and you, continue to gasp for clean air. That does for this edition of the program. Great, again, to have you with us. From Mikko Vetälä and the entire team here at Economic Byte, it's goodbye until the next program.
Insights into the Holy Quran.
Indeed, this Quran guides to what is most upright and gives the good news to the faithful who do righteous deeds, that there is a great reward for them.
In the name of Allah, the Compassionate, the Merciful, dear listeners of IRIB English Radio, Assalamu Alaikum. Welcome to another edition of the program, Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hawza Seminary of Qom. Please stay with us.
أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم الحمد لله رب العالمين ثم الصلاة والسلام على سيدنا محمد وآله الطاهرين In the name of Allah, the most beneficent, the most merciful. Hello everyone, I'm Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi and we're going to be with you with another edition of the program Insights into the Holy Quran. And in this edition of the program, we'll try to discuss the commentary of chapter Shu'ara, the 26th chapter of the Holy Quran. We'll be back after you listen to the verses we're going to discuss in this episode.
A'udhu billahi minash shaytanir rajim. Idh qala lahum akhuhum Nuhun ala tattaqun.
When their brother Noah said to them, "Will you not fear Allah?"
إِنِّي لَكُمْ رَسُولٌ أَمِينٌ
Indeed, I am to you a trustworthy messenger.
فَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ وَأَطِيعُونَ
So fear Allah and obey me.
Dear listeners, we have reached the 107th verse of Surah Al-Shu'ara, in which the Holy Quran states, كذبت قوم نوح المرسلين إذ قال لهم أخوهم نوح ألا تتقون إني لكم رسول أمين Verily, I am unto you a trustworthy messenger, فاتقوا الله وأطيعون So be in awe of Allah and obey me. From these verses, the story of Prophet Noah and his invitation of people to monotheism starts. Now, from the beginning of this journey, he tries to awaken the conscience of the people by proposing an important question. أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ? Now, since one of the important conditions, one of the prerequisites for the one who is inviting people to religion of the Almighty Allah is that people accept his words and accept him as a trustworthy man, he introduces himself. Verily, I am unto you a trustworthy messenger. إِنِّي لَكُمْ رَسُولٌ أَمِينٌ. Now, this statement shows that Noah had a long and continued background of honesty among his people. Otherwise, he couldn't have been called أخوهم in the verse, and people did not accept him as one of their brothers. So, people used to know him with his very decent quality. So, he says, for this reason, he is trustworthy in conveying the divine mission, and they would never see any treachery in it. He first introduces himself. He reminds them that I have lived among you. You have known me for a long time, that I cannot be but trustworthy even in conveying the mission of my Lord, so you need to accept my invitation. إِذْ قَالَ لَهُمْ أَخُوهُمْ نُوحٌ أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ إِنِّي لَكُمْ رَسُولٌ أَمِينٌ. Verily, I am unto you a trustworthy messenger.
We hope and pray that Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala blesses us with the ability to cover more of His divine
word. In this series of programs, we will inshallah discuss the Holy Quran with a thematic approach.
We will inshallah discuss the chapter.
تعلقا وتلاه في جنح الدجى متدبرا.
The context in which Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala speaks in this verse is the context of mentioning the ills and problems and evils of the people of the book, the previous nations who have received revelation, and more particularly the Jew.
Now let's listen to some of the verses of the Holy Quran.
First, let's listen to a few verses.
Now let's listen to some verses of the Holy Quran.
Insights into the Holy Quran by Sayyid Muhammad Hassan Mudarrisi, a graduate of the Hausa Seminary of Qom.
So as you can see, dear listeners, sometimes introducing yourself for the people, somehow praising yourself, this cannot be somehow called self-compliment. Because sometimes the people need to be reminded of what is truly happening before their eyes. So at first he awakens the people with this question, أَلَا تَتَّقُونَ? He reminds them of his situation and how he has lived among them. إِنِّي لَكُمْ رَسُولٌ أَمِينٌ. And at the next stage he says, فَاتَّقُوا اللَّهَ وَأَطِيعُونَ. So be in awe of Allah and obey me. The Quranic phrase ittaqu Allah, be in awe of Allah, fear of Allah, has occurred prior to ati'un and obey me in this verse. It might be for this reason that it wants to tell us that there will not exist any obedience
from the Messenger of Allah, unless there is faith and being in awe of Allah. I mean, if you do not accept the Almighty Allah, if you do not believe in monotheism at first, you will not be the one who will follow the teachings and orders of his prophets as well. So you need to be believing in the Lord of the worlds at first, and then you can start to follow the prophet of the Almighty Allah. So this system of invitation of the prophet for the people is somehow new. First, he was from among the people. Then he reminds them that I am trustworthy and you can trust me that I am conveying this mission from my Lord to you without any treachery. And then he reminds them again of the contents of invitation. You need to know Allah, you need to be in awe of him, and you need to obey me as a result of believing in the Lord of the worlds. We will continue the story of Prophet Noah and his people in the next episodes, God willing. Thank you, brothers and sisters, for staying with us in this episode. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Don't be saddened by what you see, by all the lies and treachery. Life is cruel, but don't worry. In your heart lies the key to unwind all the secrets. This life we see.
Thank you, dear listeners of IRIB English, for listening to us. If you have any question regarding our programs, feel free to email us at englishradio@irib.ir. Also, visit our website at parsetoday.com. Until the next program, take care and goodbye.
This is IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
The first methodology that the Quran uses is to talk to the emotional side of the human being.
Ya ayyuhal ladhina amanu, O you who believe, استعينوا بالصبر والصلاة.
And we have set forth for mankind in this Quran full of examples.
Minbar, a lecture on Islamic issues.
Islam is a way of life, a complete way. It's a complete way.
Dear audience of IRIB English Radio, now it's time to listen to a short speech by Sayyid Asad Jafari.
Cultivating an Islamic identity has been our ongoing topic. It's a massive topic. It's a massive undertaking. And we've talked about everything from the components of an identity, from the who-ness and the I-ness, to the power of thoughts, to the mind, body, and soul discussion. We then travel to the mawani' and the barriers of this identity, being this internalized Islamophobia, a fear of rejection, and of course the destructive power of doubt. That led us to two discussions. One is the need to be distinct, and one is the need of knowledge. It is important that we understand that all of this cannot be done without seeking the help of God. He's the wrapping paper in this whole gift. Turn to Him, beg Him, ask Him. I know a lot of you. There's no enmity towards God in this room. Nobody here wakes up thinking, you know, I'm going to break God's commands. Watch what I do to God. Nobody does that. Everybody has this desire to be close to God. Turn to Him and ask Him, beg Him, believe in the power of dua. Because what I'm asking all of you to do and myself to do, like I said, is a lifelong mission. And yes, you'll have ups and downs. The very nature of faith is that it fluctuates. Don't be a little bit alarmed if you have those little bit low energy days when it comes to faith. That's okay. Provided, like I said, time and time again, you don't go crashing down. I don't go crashing down. Keep it within a happy medium. So tonight, I want to look at God. We got to change a little bit of the way that we look at God. That's why I said the very basis of this discussion is Tawheed. I talked about knowledge now a couple of nights ago. Before that, I talked about certainty. We can't just rely on my madrasa when I was 14 years old. That was 1 hour, 2 hours on Sunday. Even if you go to an Islamic school, it's not enough. We have to begin to build on that knowledge and begin to live the life, the harmonization of that life together. God is telling us with this idea of fad'uhu biha, that everything that you see as different elements of me is actually one. That's actually tawheed. So yes, when I call out Ya Razik, I don't realize it, but I'm calling out Ya Rahman, Ya Rahim, Ya Ghafoor. All those jamali aspects as well. He won't give us unless He loves us. He won't give us unless He respects us. He won't give us unless He accepts us. And He loves us. And He forgives us. It's not possible. He's bound by His justice. Nothing is arbitrary in the world of Allah. It's not like, okay, by chance, let me give Asad Jafri today. No. He's a merit-based God. Nothing is given to you based on your last name, your first name, Sayyid, non-Sayyid, this and that. No one's going to ask you in your grave what your last name is. I'm sorry. Or if you write Sayyid on your passport form or not. I'm sorry. I don't want to upset anybody. You have to earn that. I have to earn that. If that's the case, then yes, the very thing you're asking for is wrapped by His love. That's why the ulama say that eventually now, everything absorbs into His jamal. It's a matter of us looking at God as one entity. There are things that are, you know, that are part of the essence, right? I mean, I used to ask, you know, one passion of mine is teaching. I love teaching. I love it more than the pulpit. Give me a whiteboard, give me a marker, I'm very old school, and I'm in my element. And this discussion on Tawheed, whether it's, you know, my Sunday school students that I have that are 12 years old, 13 years old, or sometimes I teach, you know, a little bit older. I always ask them the same question. Can you make sugar salty? Can you make sugar salty? Can you? Bashir, right? Can you make sugar salty? Can you make salt sweet? Oh, can you make salt sweet? You can't? Why can't I add sugar to salt? Yeah. You can add sugar to salt, no problem. But don't call it salt. The definition of salt is its saltiness. You cannot remove the saltiness from the salt. You can't. That's what makes it salt. Trying to remove the NaCl equation, remove the Na, remove the Cl, you can't do that. Once it's mixed, it's mixed. Sometimes I think people like me try to separate these things from God. We can't. As much as you've convinced yourself that my bias of God is something negative, I'm telling you that even that negative has a positive built into it. Don't let shaitan infiltrate. There are some of you now who want to be accepted by God and you feel like he doesn't accept me. And that's a disrespect to God. I think sometimes that God wants to punish me. And flat out he says in the Quran, مَا يَفْعَلَ اللَّهُ بِعَذَابِكُمْ. What would I gain out of punishing you? Do you think I created you to punish you? You think that's what I want to do? You think I enjoy the fact that you're going through this hardship right now? That your mother is fighting cancer? I'm up there, enjoying myself? No. But I do understand that built into this cancer fight of yours is beauty. You may not see it right away, because sometimes when we're right here in the storm, we can't see everything else. But you will see it one day. We can't allow shaitan to enter our system and change our bias. It's one shaitan versus thousands of prophets. One shaitan versus 12 imams. One shaitan versus parents, grandparents, uncles, aunts, ulama, Quran, so many. To the point the Quran says, on the day of judgment, we'll say, God, it wasn't me, it was him. He made me do it. The guy there with the red thorns and the pitchfork over there. He's the one. Blame him. He goes, whoa. Oh, it's not. No. I'm not. I suggested to you. That's it. I said, look, maybe try this. I gave you a recommendation. You accepted that recommendation. But then he says, all these thousands of perfect beings also recommended to you. Little old me now, all of a sudden, you're going to say yes to? And then blame me on top of that? That's why it's important. It's a balance. أَنِعْبُدُ اللَّهَ وَاسْتَنِبُ الطَّاغُوتِ. Worship Allah, shun shaitan. Worship Allah, shun shaitan. Two messages every prophet did. Right? لَقَدْ بَعَثْنَا فِي كُلِّ أُمَّةٍ رَسُولًا. Every nation we sent a prophet to, two messages. Worship Allah. At the same time, parallel to shun shaitan. Understand your enemy. Dushman shinasi is very, very important. Recognition of the enemy is very, very important. Right? You're building a building of 20 floors on a very, very weak base. Floor 18, the building collapses. What's the point? Strengthen your base. Change the bias of God. But understand, even if you have a jalali, fearful bias of God, that can easily be turned into love and beauty. It's a matter of your vision. You know, Zulaikha is sitting there and she is the talk of the town. Ridiculed by other women. You are somebody who is, you know, revered and respected. This is a slave boy of yours. Why are you chasing him around town? And she knew that no matter how much she could try to describe the beauty and the husn of Nabi Yusuf, she couldn't. So she, of course, arranges for this event with all the women. And orchestrated beautifully. At the right time, at the right moment, he is to come out and he is, of course, to bring them something, Yusuf. So they're all there, of course. Fruit is there, the knives are there. You've heard the story several times. Fruit is there, and out walks Nabi Yusuf. While they're cutting their fruit, they begin cutting their hand. Mesmerized by his beauty. They can't even feel the pain anymore. Yani the jalali aspect of cutting the finger succumbs to the jamal of Yusuf. To the point where they actually look at the beautiful and are reminded of the beauty. This is not a Bashar man, he has to be an angel. No man is this beautiful. It's very possible that something that you think is trauma, that you think is difficult, actually it will get you to that source of beauty. It's very possible.
You're listening to Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran. This program entitled Minbar. Our email address is englishradio@irib.ir.
Energy analysts are saying the implementation of an oil price cap that the United States and its allies, the Group of Seven, have agreed to place on Russian oil imports may initially cause a sharp decrease in Russian oil in the market and, as a result, a jump in the oil price. We take a look at the world media's coverage of this issue. Please stay with us. English website of Al Jazeera television network has covered this story. The Kremlin has rejected a $60 per barrel price cap that the United States and its allies in the European Union and the Group of Seven industrialized nations have agreed to place on Russian oil imports as an attempt to starve Moscow's ongoing campaign in Ukraine. Kremlin spokesman Dmitry Peskov told news agencies on Saturday, 3rd of December, "We will not accept this price cap." The bloc and the Group of Seven industrialized nations that includes the United Kingdom, Germany, Italy, Canada, United States, France and Japan announced the agreement alongside Australia on Friday, 2nd of December, saying they would start imposing the price ceiling on Monday, 5th of December. The European Union is also slated to start enforcing an oil embargo of its own on Russian crude oil deliveries that would ban seaborne shipments, which reportedly account for two-thirds of the imports of the European Union. The G7 group claimed by employing the cap, it was delivering on its vow to prevent Russia from profiting from its special operation in Ukraine, to support stability in global energy markets, and to minimize negative economic spillovers of Russia's operation. Russia's conflict in Ukraine started in late February, with Moscow saying it was aimed at defending pro-Russian population in eastern Ukraine, particularly in the regions of Luhansk and Donetsk. Ever since the beginning of the operation, Kiev's Western allies, led by the United States of America, have been pumping Ukraine full of advanced weapons and snapping sanctions on Russia, steps that Moscow says will only prolong the hostilities. The White House has described the price cap deal as welcome news, claiming the agreement would help limit Russian President Vladimir Putin's ability to fund its special operation in Ukraine. However, Ukrainian President Volodymyr Zelensky downplayed the measure, saying it would not do enough to keep the Russian campaign in check. Zelensky said, "Now the world discussion on price caps, that is, on limiting the export price of Russian oil, has ended, unfortunately, with no serious decisions, because you wouldn't call it a serious decision to set such a limit for Russian prices, which is quite comfortable for the budget of Russia." Andrei Yermak, head of Zelensky's administration, also claimed the price cap should have been set at $30 a barrel to destroy Russia's economy. The Reuters news agency has also covered the same story. The Russian embassy in the United States says Kremlin will keep looking for buyers for its oil, despite a dangerous attempt by the West to introduce a $60 price cap on Russian oil, amid a pressure campaign against Moscow over its conflict in Ukraine. From 5th of December onwards, Western shipping and insurance companies would be prohibited from handling Russian oil sold above the price cap. In Washington, Russia's embassy said the latest attempt was part of a larger plan for reshaping the free market principles. The Russian embassy said in a statement, "Russia's oil would still continue to be in demand." It said steps like these will inevitably result in increasing uncertainty and imposing higher costs for raw materials consumers. The statement added, "Regardless of the current flirtations with a dangerous and illegitimate instrument, we are confident that Russian oil will continue to be in demand." U.S. Treasury Secretary Janet Yellen claimed, "With Russia's economy already contracting and its budget increasingly stretched thin, the price gap will immediately cut into Putin's most important source of revenue." Senior Russian politician Leonid Slutsky said Russia can partially annul the restriction by moving to sell its oil in other markets such as India and Russia. Citing an oil ministry source, Reuters news agency reported on Friday, 2nd of December, that New Delhi will continue buying Russian oil and even look for term contracts as sanctions allow purchase, provided that Western services are not used. On 29th of November, Chinese President Xi Jinping reassured that he is willing to build a closer partnership with Russia in energy cooperation. China and India are currently the largest single buyers of Russian crude oil. Britain's Guardian newspaper has more. The cap on the price of Russian oil transported by sea is designed to affect the country's exports worldwide, in addition to the EU-wide embargo on Russian crude oil, which comes into force on 5th of December. Countries not party to the deal will only be able to access services such as insurance, shipping and brokerage if they trade Russian oil at or below the $60 price cap. As the countries involved in the deal, such as the United Kingdom, the belief is that most countries and businesses will be forced to comply. In a statement, G7 countries claimed they hoped the deal would also work to reduce the price of oil for low to middle income countries, who have felt the impact of the conflict in Ukraine disproportionately. On Thursday, Russia's Foreign Minister Sergei Lavrov said Moscow had dismissed the impact of the price cap and would negotiate with its partners directly. The G7 agreement came after much debate with Poland, party to the deal as an EU member and one of Ukraine's closest allies, which had pushed for a price cap to be as low as $30 a barrel, arguing that to squeeze Russia's economy, the price cap should be lower. But G7 countries concluded that the price of $60 a barrel would prevent a rise in global oil prices that would put strain on countries already experiencing high inflation. Russian officials suggested Western economies may not be so lucky. Mikhail Ulyanov, Russia's representative to the international organizations in Vienna, said, "Starting from this year, Europe will live without Russian oil. Moscow has already made it clear that it will not supply oil to those countries who support the anti-market price cap." US President Joe Biden said on Thursday, 1st of December, that he would talk to Russia's President Vladimir Putin about the conflict only if he could see an indication that Russia was prepared to pull out of Ukraine. Joe Biden said, "There's one way for this war to end, the rational way. Putin should pull out of Ukraine. I'm prepared to speak with Vladimir Putin if in fact there is an interest in him deciding he's looking for a way to end the war." Reacting to Joe Biden's comments, Vladimir Putin said he would enter into talks only if Ukraine recognizes Russia's annexation of the southern and eastern areas of Ukraine.
IRIB English Radio presents Viewpoints.
Viewpoints.
With the presence of different scholars.
With the presence of different scholars. IRIB English Radio.
Bismillah ar-Rahman ar-Rahim. Assalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh. Dear listeners, sisters and brothers from all around the world, this is IRIB English Radio, and today I have the pleasure to be the host of this episode of Point of View. I am Bita at your service, and with me I have two dear guest speakers, my dear brother Ali. Assalamu alaikum.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. Thank
and my dear brother,
me.
Muhammad, assalamu alaikum
wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullah. It's a pleasure to be here.
Yeah, it's my pleasure too to have you in here in this controversial discussion, which I'm really interested in. So we're going to go through our topic today, which is actually voluntary public forces, that we call it as basij in our own country. You're telling me that there is a strong connection between these kind of leaders, these people who just persuade other people to come for this aid and for helping others in different aspects. But the thing I want to ask you right now is, how about non-Islamic countries? Do they have other leaders like that? Or they literally have public voluntary forces or something like that? Or no, they are trying to have something like this. What is the story about
that? Yeah, they
that
tried. Kind of if you look at the Arab uprising, the so-called Arab Spring recently, that's uh-huh. what they were trying to do in Egypt and in Tunisia and stuff. The people themselves, though, you see, you have to consider the strong leadership as well. What lacked, in my opinion, in this Arab Spring
yeah.
was the proper leadership. And that's what made it just, you know, go away in that instance. And it had so a lot of useless. Negative effects as well. With a proper leadership and this public voluntary force, a movement would be successful. And you brought up the question about more modern ways. The best and the most way of, you know, more ethically approaching a movement is through a public voluntary force.
Yeah.
Other ways, you see coup d'etat, you see, for example, military takeover of a government, of a movement. These are not ethical. These are forces.
I want to add a complimentary point to the explanations
yeah.
of the brother.
In
and
order.
Just to cover your previous and this question of yours. Actually, you said that it might not work today because we are highly developed and the countries or, I don't know, communities might not be in need of such.
Not only these, but I think the modern civilization, the modern society is somehow mm-hmm. more selfish than the past time. Mm-hmm. And also, this is the main problem.
So, yeah, exactly. I wanted to say that this movement itself is something against selfishness of the societies because it
exactly.
is something that brings people to involve for their own affairs. So this is the involvement of masses of the nation
mm-hmm.
for their own sakes, right? So do you think that people would get stuck in case they are asked just for your own affair, for your family? For the people in your vicinity, you are going to do a service and give a service to the people around.
Yeah.
See, that's why they are motivated with this actually motivation that this is something for the betterment of the life of other Muslims or other, let's say, neighbors of yours. So we see that it's still today, it's still this concept and this movement is valid and it works. And to this question of yours that you ask lastly, on the other countries, are they
yeah.
able to have such a thing? I think when we have taken this model from Islam, I mean, a model from the Holy Prophet, sallallahu alaihi wasallam, so it means that all Muslim countries and even non-Muslim countries can take some lessons from that.
Yeah, it comes
we have
from
seen
a godly
that, for example,
source. It comes from a godly source.
Yeah, it comes from a divine and godly source. Then look, as we saw in the history that many leaders of the world have taken their lessons from Imam Hussein alayhi salam, from the kind of, let's say, freedom and freedom seeking that he injected to the soul of the people after him. You see, we have some people who are not following Islam and they are not actually Muslims in general, but Muslims at all, but they are actually saying that they have taken their lessons from Imam Hussein alayhi salam. The same way that people from, specifically from Islamic Ummah, to take their lesson from the Holy Prophet and to involve people in their own affairs. In case you see a Muslim country is needless of such movement and activity, we have to doubt. It means that there is a, let's say, gap between the let's say administration and the nation.
Yeah.
You see? In case these gaps are available, these forces would be more weak and even they might not exist. But in countries that the people are going to involve in their own affairs, in their own issues of the of their own country, like what happened in Syria. And look, Syria, there was a great gap in between the administration and the nation. But slowly, slowly, the gap was filled with these, let's say, mobilization forces. And they came to help Syria with that, let's say, great fitna or great...
sedition.
Great sedition that they were afflicted with. So they actually survived Syria with that.
Yeah.
And now we, in our vicinity in Iraq, the group which is called Hashd al-Sha'bi, the same way that actually they took the idea and they imitated, I can't say, I don't know, even from ours or even from the dawn of Islam, it depends on them from where they have taken this source.
You know, I have a problem here that, you know, you are telling me that, okay, this motivation comes from the Islam and Islamic contents, Islamic beliefs, the leadership and something. And you told me that when the gap is somehow more in a country you are living in, between your leadership and the administration and the nation, this besiege or I don't know, the public voluntary forces somehow weakened. But my question is that if the motivation is that, so when, for example, I immigrate to another country, what should I do? Is it my responsibility to go for public voluntary forces? Is it my responsibility to, for example, to go help when I'm in another country? I mean that. Is it an act of a nationalism or something?
No, not necessarily. It's not an act of nationalism. You see, there one aspect of besiege of the public mm-hmm. voluntary force is actually to build the country. That's for sure. But the more important aspect is to mm-hmm. safeguard the country, safeguard the people from ideologies that might affect the movement itself, right? The Islamic movement itself. That's why, as I mentioned previously as well, one of the very key aspects of this public voluntary force is the leadership of this public voluntary
yeah.
force. You might find very patriotic people in a country who are very much, aggrieved of the situation of their countries, and they want the management to change. They want to bring, and they have that public voluntary force ready, but there is no leadership. And that's why the governments are able to, you know, suppress them and take control of them
yeah.
with the military that they have. But with a proper leadership in the center of this besiege, this public voluntary force will be able to flourish that country. Not only in the military areas, not only in the areas where you mentioned, and I'm not saying specific to Iran, anywhere you go. The success to an Islamic movement was besieged. So if you go to a country, even if you migrate outside of Iran, and you see, for example, Islamic communities, right? Those Islamic communities that are administered and operated, and their main human resource is this public voluntary force of that masjid, of that community, they were more successful than those who have this leader-only, you know, opinion.
One more point I want to add that
yeah.
Islam is usually against all different formats of isms, that like that of nationalism, or
yeah.
I don't know, humanism, all different formats of that. Islam is in favor of giving the service to humanity. And in defining this humanity, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala doesn't tell you that this humanity that I'm talking about is necessarily Muslim.
Yeah.
No, Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala says if you save the one's life, it's as if you save the whole people's lives. The whole world's lives. So that, what does it mean? Allah never told you in case you save one the life of a Muslim. You see,
yeah.
So it has a generality. When we are talking about this movement and their functionality, it doesn't matter if we are living in this country or the other country. As far as we are going to give a service to human beings, so we are in this circle. So we are going to be known as the members of this circle to be at the service of humanity. The same way that we serve them, they might or might not serve to us.
So there is a personality needed for this mindset, if you do agree with me. For example, you are going to sacrifice your life, for example, in a military side of a country for a country to save other people. And for doing that, there should, you have to be a kind of personality to do that, if you mm-hmm. do agree with
so
me.
So that's why it's not compulsory.
It is not, but, you know,
even inside
public.
Our country, even in our country, it's not something compulsory. Imam Khomeini, rahmatullah, said that I wish that we have 20 million of, at that time, that the population of Iran was almost 60. Oh, sorry, it was 55 something. Imam said that I wish that we have 20 million of Basij members. So I mean that for 55 million, 20 million can handle all the affairs of the society. I mean, to help them in case they are in need.
My question is, how can we be from that part? You know what I mean? I think you have to be somehow qualified for being from this public voluntary force. Nowadays, even youth generation is just don't tend to that much do such a thing, for example, for his own people, even for his own sake. Mm. You know what I mean? I mean that we should have somehow a systematic, actually, motivation for this youth generation. But what is it? Where is it?
Definitely, these motivations are not quite the same in different years and in different ages. Sometimes it is more stronger, sometimes they are weaker.
Yeah.
Look, at times that even there is an issue of martyrdom and shahada, usually mm-hmm. this motivation goes higher. And we see that the members are usually more. At the time of the imposed war between Iran and Iraq, because the numbers of shahada, even blood is quite a famous saying, that blood brings life.
Yeah.
When lots of blood, almost 200,000 of the young youth of this country got martyred, so it means that this motivation makes them stronger. I want to give you another example. At the time that Colonel Soleimani got martyred, have you seen the, let's say, population who came just to participate in his funeral? It means that when there is a blood and the blood is for an important person, it gives a bigger life to the whole society and Ummah. So it gives them this motivation to have more, to get more motivated, to get motivated more to join such forces. Yes, at times, for example, at the time of Quarantine, as you said, we had less because people were at homes and they'd be busy with their own problems and I don't know. The diseased ones, and there was sort of, let's say, sorrow in the people. So definitely the people who joined them were less. But all in all, if you want to find a statistic of the number of the people who joined and mm-hmm. are still members of Basij, not only in Iran, but also in Iraq and Syria and other neighboring countries like Yemen or even countries outside Asia, you see, the majority of the members of them are youth.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Yeah.
So you
just to compliment Brother Ali's point, I'll also like to touch upon the public voluntary force of Lebanon, Hezbollah, and he talked about how when there is blood, life is even more empowered. The reason is because the most important, the most valued thing for a human being is his own life. When you see your brother take that step, your brother or your sister take that step in risking his life for yours, you understand that how valuable he sees you and your movement.
Yeah.
And so that's why in the war between Lebanon and Israel, Hezbollah and Israel, you will see that a force of, I don't know, maybe a couple of hundred youths from voluntary youths from Lebanon, and they weren't fighting for their, necessarily their land. They were fighting against oppression. And that is very much clear. They weren't the reason was because they had entered their land, but they were fighting. Their motivation was to fight against oppression. Hezbollah, with all their forces, they have a couple of hundred, probably one or two helicopters, not much, artilleries. But Israel, with all the high technology they had and all the forces they had, they were not able to combat this voluntary public force.
Yeah.
Because of the power it gives. And this way, when the Hezbollahi soldiers, they would enter into the battlefield, they would enter to give life. But on the other side, when they would come, they would enter to save their life.
Mm-hmm.
That's why the more they went ahead, the further the enemy was backing off.
So I want to make a challenge for you. Just let me one sentence that you can make me motivated for going for public voluntary force. Just one sentence. You first, Brother Ali, please.
It doesn't need any reason. You can, the same way that Imam Hussein sacrificed his own life and his own family. We cannot even imagine that 18 people from one family get martyred and killed in one day for the... for the lives of others.
So
for the and for the others to get saved.
So as you see, this is a really difficult task to have a motivation, have a actually united motivation for something to do. And public voluntary force is something which is public, and you have to be actually united for this public thing to be done. And I think it is really difficult, and I'm really proud of the history of the Islamic history, actually, which showed to the world that it is possible to make all the people think in a right way. way, and not all of them, actually, the majority of people think in a right way and go for that, do something for that, and sacrifice something for this.
Definitely. I like to suggest all the brothers and sisters who are listening to this show just to read the story of Shahrukh. This is a book that has been about a person from Basij that entered the... it is one of the miracles of this movement that this person was quite a different person that entered this Basij, and finally he got martyred.
Actually, thank you for your suggestion. Thank you, my dear brothers, for the discussion of today. I hope you enjoyed all of it. Wassalamu alaikum wa rahmatullahi wa barakatuh.
Wa alaikum assalam wa rahmatullahi.
يقولها لنا يوم القيامة أمتي يقولها شفاعة أنا لها
Just listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran broadcasting. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily round the clock for listeners across the globe. The Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran can be heard via the internet, shortwave, FM, and satellite. Our listeners in the Indian subcontinent can listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 31 meters, 9,650 kilohertz, every day from 15:20 to 16:20 UTC. Also, our listeners in Europe can tune in to the English service of the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran via shortwave 49 meters, 6,040 kilohertz, and in Southern Africa via shortwave 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz every day from 1920 to 2020 UTC. Our listeners in Tehran can also listen to our programs via FM 91.5 megahertz. You can also listen to the Voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird, Eutelsat 3B, and Iransat or Bat 5, and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details. Please send your correspondence to the English program PO Box number 19395-6767, Tehran, Islamic Republic of Iran, or email us to englishradio@irib.ir. We would be very pleased to have your comments about audio quality and other means. Thank you.
و
وقضى ربك ألا تعبدوا إلا إياه وبالوالدين إحسانا.
Your Lord has decreed that you shall not worship anyone except him.